to episode 6 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by two of our regulars, Michael Vadas, who was formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department and is now a partner in our New York office, and Jason Weinstein, who was formerly of the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. And we're pleased to have with us for an interview and for any advice he wants to offer during the news roundup, we're joined by John Rizzo, who's senior counsel at Steptoe, author of the recently released Company Man, a very well-selling memoir of his time as a CIA lawyer, including acting general counsel for years at a time. I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with NSA and DHS, and currently holding the record for rejoining Steptoe and Johnson the greatest number of times in history. So let's get started. As has become traditional, we're going to do this week in the National Security Agency because there's always new news affecting the law about NSA. Two developments in the context of the National Security Agency. Google and Yahoo and Microsoft released their transparency reports reflecting much more detail about the kind of Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act orders they've received, including the number of accounts that had been disclosed to the government under FISA orders. Total in 6 months for all three of them of, I believe, 59,000 accounts, which sounds like a lot until you realize that those three companies among them probably have a billion accounts. This is well under one-tenth, really well under probably 1/100th of 1% of the accounts, which is starting to put your likelihood of being wiretapped in as a result of a FISA order somewhere in the neighborhood of the risk of getting hit by lightning on your way to work.
It's probably even better than that, right? I mean, because it's not as though there are 59,000 subjects of FISA orders. I would think that would mean that some subjects or most subjects use multiple accounts, and that's why they're
That's probably right, because there are many fewer orders than there are accounts described, which suggests that when the government gets these FISA orders, often FISA orders on an individual agent of a foreign power, they identify four or five accounts that that particular agent is using. That's probably right. Okay, the other interesting and quite surprising development to me was a story disclosing that, in fact, this program, the telephony metadata program that NSA is in such trouble over for scooping up all the communications of Americans, actually is scooping up the communications of less than 30% of Americans. If I understand it from the story, the government used to get most of those communications, and the numbers have been dropping because of difficulty dealing with mobile phone numbers. And the particular difficulty is that NSA does not want and hasn't asked for and isn't authorized to obtain location information. And scrubbing the databases that they're getting of even cell site location data turns out to be surprisingly difficult. And rather than take the data and ignore the location data, they've been refusing the data. This is it is typical of the privacy groups that they would complain about scooping up 30% or 100%. Then when it turns out to be 30%, say, see, the program doesn't work. And when it's pointed out that the reason that the government isn't getting it is because of their privacy protections, to say, well, that just shows that the whole thing is a bad idea. I'm not sure what NSA can do here, right? It's their compliance structure that has put them in this position, and now they're getting screwed for the for being scrupulous about not taking stuff with additional data. All right, that is the week in NSA. So let's talk instead about the week in privacy, and probably the most remarkable and head-scratching moment in private privacy law came when we discovered that the Target compromises were the result of someone who broke in through the connection that the HVAC provider had to Target. And a lot of people said, why is your heating contractor given authority to enter your system, and what does this tell us about the nature of the intrusion? Jason, what do you think is going on here?
Well, if we have two regular features, one is about the NSA and one seems to be about Target.
That's right. So
in our last episode, I think we had touched on briefly the fact that there were some preliminary reports that the hackers who broke into Target system had done so through their HVAC contractor. Since we were together last, I think more details have come out, and Target has acknowledged that's the case. And the HVAC contractor, a company in Pennsylvania, apparently had access to Target's network for the purpose of remotely monitoring energy consumption and temperature at Target stores, which by itself is not troubling. What it may suggest is that Target's network was not properly segmented, so that once those credentials were compromised, the hackers could move about the network and get to more to other parts of the network that were more that were really their targets. So I think it's a good reminder to companies that give access to their data or to some portion of the network to a contractor to make sure that the contractor has access to only that portion of the network that they truly need, and that additional credentials are needed to access other systems. The other development last week was a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing at which Target CFO and Vice President from Neiman Marcus testified, along with Mike Lee Rahman, the AG for the Assistant AG for the Criminal Division, and Edith Ramirez from the FTC. There are a couple interesting takeaways from that. Edith Ramirez from the FTC called for data security legislation and data breach notification legislation, and it's interesting and perhaps ironic that she called for legislation giving the FTC the authority to impose data security standards on the same week that the FTC announced its 50th settlement of a data security case under its existing.
As they're celebrating a decade of lawlessly imposing right. these provisions.
Well, right. Some
well,
would say
not just that, but in the LabMD case, the FTC specifically rejected arguments that it lacked statutory authority now to go after companies with what the FTC thinks are shoddy security practices. So they're out there explicitly saying we've got the authority now. The legislation would expand it to allow them to go after other people to apply civil penalties and the like. I think that's the main thing they're looking for now.
Yeah, in fact, their spin that they put on it in the written testimony was that it would, and I'm using air quotes here, strengthen their existing authority. So it's the spin is to not acknowledge that you don't have the authority, but just assert that the authority needs to be made more clear.
Well, and to be fair, sort of, to the FTC, what they have said to people is, look, you can contest this authority, but you'll go out of business before you get to the end of that process. And indeed, I think this week LabMD announced that it was going out of business because it couldn't afford to continue fighting the FTC.
That's right. In fact, I think only two companies out of more than 50 that the FTC has come after have fought the FTC's authority, and 50% of them now have announced that they're going out of business. So those are bad odds. One of the other takeaways that came out of the hearing was a window into how sophisticated the attacks were. In fact, in Neiman Marcus's case, they described discovering that the malware that was used had features that appeared to have been custom written based on Neiman Marcus's own network, which suggests that the hackers were in the network doing reconnaissance for some period of time, learning how it worked, and then designing or tailoring the features in the malware to be most effective in their network.
Well, what could be more appropriate since Neiman Marcus every year at Christmas announces some custom tailored for people who in Texas who have more money than they need.
That's right. They're also, you know, when I was at the department prior to the Stop Online Piracy Act and all the IP legislation that became such a controversial issue, it seemed that every member of the Judiciary Committee at some point had IP legislation, and now it appears that every member of the Judiciary Committee has or is co-sponsoring some piece of data security or data privacy legislation. Senator Leahy has introduced legislation. Senator Feinstein, Senator Rockefeller, Senator Menendez, I think Senator Blumenthal, all have introduced, and others, I'm sure I'm leaving some out, legislation to get at some aspect of data security standards or data breach notification standards in their rush to demonstrate their commitment to consumers. What will be interesting is to see whether what they learned at the hearing will actually affect the tenor of the public remarks about the victims of the breach. As we talk about all the time, companies that are victims of breaches are victims of crime, and they're often not treated that way. They're treated as perpetrators of the crime or somehow accomplices of the crime by legislators and others. And it'll be interesting to see if the information that came out of the hearing about just how sophisticated the attackers were will change the orientation of some of those members of Congress, that they'll start to appreciate the fact that these companies, even companies that take reasonable or more than reasonable security standards or security measures, can be hacked because the adversaries that are after are determined and sophisticated.
What do you think is the risk of liability for the heating contractor? All of these hundreds of millions of dollars worth of costs that Target is going to incur can be tracked back to something that happened as a result of his access. He obviously is going to be able to pay $400 million, but I wonder whether Target is in a position to say, we would have been secure but for you.
Well, it's a very interesting question. It's something that anybody who has contractors who have access to their system should right now be looking at their contracts and seeing if those contracts impose any obligation on the contractor to maintain reasonable cybersecurity measures and address the question of liability and indemnification. If your contractor, if a weakness in your contractor system creates an attack on yours, you may be limited in what recourse you have with that contractor, and you ought to be making sure that you have the maximum recourse possible.
Yeah, which will at least make them serious. Yes?
Mike? Another interesting thing about that HVAC access is that it points up the vulnerabilities of the so-called Internet of Things. You know, we're all going to have our refrigerators online so we can check whether we've got milk at home before we get home, and we'll have the ability to control our heat ourselves and our air conditioning remotely. But, you know, if hackers could get a Target through the HVAC contractor, same sort of vulnerability would apply to those of us who do connect to the Internet, our houses, our cars, et cetera, unless, you know, there's a clear and very strong firewall between access to those things and access to your sensitive information that you have on your home computers.
And I'm sure everybody's going to do that until somebody thinks, well, wouldn't it be nice if I could do this from my computer, right? And then they're going to connect it, all it takes is one hole. I'm sure that was a good idea to connect the heating contractor to the system. And the easiest way to do that was just to give him logon credentials, mm-hmm. as opposed to setting up an entirely new and segregated system where only the heating information could be accessed.
That's right.
So yeah, it's doing what comes naturally that's dangerous.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Speaking of doing what comes naturally, the French, in the name of human rights, are doing remarkable things to free expression. The privacy law, I'm always struck by how often privacy law turns out to interfere with people's right to speak or to know things. And that's certainly true in the Google case, where Google combined all of its services under a single privacy policy and gathered information under that policy. The French Data Protection Authority said, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to have that information without consent, and the consent has to be service by service. You're not allowed to use that information unless you say some magic words that restrict you to using data only for individual services as opposed to across the board. That wasn't enough. They fined Google the maximum amount, which was 150,000 euros, and they said, well, we don't think that hurt you enough. We're going to make you say things as well as tell you what you have to say, what you can't say, and what you can't know. And so I think right now, certainly within the last 2 days, Google has had to post on their homepage, the famously clean homepage, a little government-dictated notice saying Google has been found to have violated data protection law in France and fined 150,000 euros. And if you want to learn more, here's the link. So French government promoting links to itself at the expense of Google. One more contribution to human rights from France. I thought we ought to start a regular feature for the dumbest press coverage of a legal issue in this area. And my first candidate would be the coverage of the LavaBit controversy, which has been covered by the tech press in particular, as though it was going to be a test case to determine, you know, all of our rights with respect to encryption and confidential email for the rest of time. And now that there's been an argument, it sounds like the judges who heard the argument didn't get the memo. Michael, what happened at the hearing, and what does it tell us about where this case is going?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, LavaBit was the communications company that resisted the government's request to get its encryption keys so that the government could monitor the communications of a particular individual who many people suspect was Edward Snowden. And LavaBit just resisted. You know, the government first got a pen register order requiring the provision of the key. Then they got a subpoena when LavaBit wouldn't respond to the pen register. And then LavaBit wouldn't respond to the subpoena, they got a search warrant. And LavaBit basically said, well, first they said, well, I'll give you the key, but what I'll do is I'll print it out and give you the printed out version of the key, which, of course, is not going to allow the government to actually decrypt the communications. And then it finally handed over the key but shut down its business, so the government had no communications to access. LavaBit then appealed and argued on appeal that all three types of orders it received were invalid. And, you know, I won't go through all the arguments except to say that the judges at the oral argument seemed highly skeptical and really thought that this case boiled down to whether a company can just refuse to abide by a facially valid court order. And it seems unlikely that LavaBit's going to win this case. It would have to win on all three arguments. You know, it would have to show that a pen register was not sufficient authority, that a subpoena wasn't sufficient, and that a search warrant wasn't lawfully authorized as well. Highly unlikely, I think.
So, yes, there was a lot of activity around this case. I think EFF and some other organizations filed briefs on the case, but it sounds as though the court's going to treat this as something pretty mundane.
Yeah, it's interesting how much play the tech press, as you say, and also the cyber libertarians give to encryption. They've had a thing for encryption that's long standing now, and every time a case comes up, you know, there have been a lot of Fifth Amendment cases where someone's been required to turn over an encryption key or to provide plain text, and then argues that, no, that would be a violation of my privilege against self-incrimination. And lots of times these groups, you know, get involved as amici, and the press gives extensive coverage, and most of the time the defendant loses, or the person whose key was sought.
Well, I have to take some responsibility for that, because I would, when I was at NSA, I very publicly defended export controls on encryption and a variety of government efforts to make sure that encryption was susceptible to law enforcement access. And that raised the enthusiasm of the tech press for making sure that never turned out to be true. And so I think probably it's also true in the effort to overcome encryption controls. People hyped the likely security value of encryption. We've had free encryption controls for export really since the late 90s, 15 years. I wouldn't say we are more secure in our internet communications than now than we were then. But the assumption on the part of techies that encryption is central to their rights and their privacy continues to ride on despite lots of experience to the contrary. So here's another Google case, but I think one that could turn out to be very much more important legally than the press is giving it credit for. Google has been trying to appeal now the class action certification and just was turned down in a very, very large case with a theory that potentially costs them billions of dollars, if I understand it right. Jason, what's going on there?
Well, this is something that actually Michael, I think, has written quite a bit about, but and that we've talked about, I think, previously. There's a class action suit in the Northern District of California alleging that Google violated the Wiretap Act through its practice of automatically scanning emails to help sell ads to its customers. And last year, I think in September, Google got an unfavorable ruling from the district judge, Lucy Koh, who allowed the plaintiffs to move forward with their wiretap claims. And in doing so, she rejected Google's contention that its users had consented to the interception of their communications represented by the scanning of the emails. And she also rejected the argument that the scanning was covered by the ordinary course of business exemption in the statute. So Google sought permission to file an interlocutory appeal, and they argued, among other things, that Judge Koh's order relied on novel interpretations of the Wiretap Act that should be reviewed, and that appellate review would help expedite the resolution of the case, because if Judge Koh was determined by the Ninth Circuit to be wrong, then the case would effectively go away. Judge Koh rejected that request. Among other things, she said that the case had been going on for 3 years and had a long and tortured procedural history, and she didn't want to delay it further. She contended, in her opinion, that proceeding with the case to a resolution would do more to bring the case to a conclusion than the interlocutory appeal would. And she actually criticized Google for not having appealed a similar order by a district judge earlier in one of the cases that later was consolidated in the case that's in front of her. There's a split even within Judge Koh's district on the application of the ordinary course of business exception. A few months after her opinion last September, there was a magistrate judge, Paul Gruhl, who dismissed a class action against Google, another aspect of Google's privacy policies, and in doing so, he interpreted the ordinary course of business exception much more broadly. So there are, I think Google's right, there are genuine first impression legal issues that would benefit from consideration by the Ninth Circuit, but as a result of Judge Koh's order, the case is going to proceed, and I think the next event in the case will be a motion for class certification at the end of this month. And it's significant not just because of the impact of the legal questions in the case against Google, but because Judge Koh's initial order in September inspired copycat litigation against Yahoo and Facebook. And so these are issues that affect, they're not academic issues at all, they're issues that affect the basic business model of some of the largest providers in the world.
I have trouble seeing how they don't certify a class. The argument is that the notice you gave to everybody fails to provide notice of what you're actually doing. And what they're actually doing is clear and applies to everybody, and the notice applied to everybody. It's kind of hard to see how you can't get a class certified on those facts. Once you've certified a class, Google is staring down the barrel of $10,000 per violation,
yeah.
Which might mean per email. They've got 400 million users or more. If those guys all sent, you know, three or four emails a year, which is not the case, I think even Google can't afford that.
Right.
which means that Judge Koh has basically said, I am going to force you to settle this case.
That's right.
You will never see this in the Ninth Circuit.
That's right.
Did she mention that she won a privy for the dumbest privacy decision of the year that decision?
No, I'm sorry for not mentioning that myself. Well deserved.
Yeah. And how unpersuasive does your opinion have to be that you can't even get a magistrate judge who works for you to go along with it?
Right.
Bizarre. And then she, for her to say, oh, yeah, well, you should have appealed some other decision, so I don't need to let you appeal this one.
I'm the second judge to issue a ruling is done, and you didn't appeal the first one. So.
Right.
You know, it seems to me, though, it would be pretty easy for Google to settle this case by simply making their privacy policy clearer on the fact that they monitor communications. You know, at least as the policy existed at the time of Judge Koh's decision, it was not the clearest privacy policy. And I think that
I think that's right.
They could make it clearer. Whether they have to pay money as well is another story.
Well, whether they should have to pay billions of dollars to get a lesson in writing clearly is a controversial proposition. Let's talk a little bit about another issue that has been in and out of the news and also probably a little overhyped, but maybe not quite so much by the press, and that is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the Aaron Swartz prosecution and the effort on the part of a substantial number of tech-conscious groups to try to get the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act amended. There's a development in that, Jason, because the Justice Department is starting to indicate flexibility on how the law might be written to narrow prosecutorial discretion. What did they offer, and how likely is it to get adopted?
Well, overhyped is actually the exact word I was thinking of, both for the issue itself and to some extent the news of the week. So with a little bit of background, so for years, critics of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act have argued that the statute is written so broadly that it would permit a federal prosecution for ordinary Internet behavior, things like or minor infractions, lying on violating terms of service, lying about your age on a dating site, checking fantasy football scores at work. Never mind, those critics can't actually point to any actual cases of that type, only hypothetical ones. There's no question the statute is not the best drafted piece of legislation in the history of the Republic. And as a technical matter, the people who argue that it's broad enough to encompass minor infractions of that nature are, as a technical matter, correct. But the federal court dockets, as I said, are not exactly filled with cases like that. And
in the interest of full disclosure, you were in charge of the oversight of this statute,
prosecutions.
Did everybody who brought a CFAA prosecution check in with you before they did it?
No. There were situations in which the historically, not necessarily during my run there, but historically where the use of the statute was deemed potentially aggressive or controversial, where there was some discussion at DOJ headquarters in conjunction with the U.S. Attorney's Office. But there's not a requirement that, at least currently, that U.S. Attorney's Offices run those potential prosecutions by main justice.
But
there
was with that one prosecution brought against Lori Drew, who was the mother of a teenager who basically adopted the persona of another teenager and had some pretty vicious emails with a girl next door who then committed suicide. She was prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles, so they had a pretty amazingly broad interpretation of the CFAA, which I think fueled the fire on the among the techies and the cyber libertarians. But notably, a judge ended up throwing that count out because he just thought that was not really allowed by the CFAA.
That's right, and it's also notable. That's one case where there was enough angst about the appropriateness of that use of the statute that there was a lot of discussion between main justice and the U.S. Attorney's Office about it, and I think considerable disagreement within the department about whether that prosecution should go forward, and ultimately the U.S. Attorney's Office was permitted to bring it. But what's noteworthy is that the department chose not to appeal after the judge threw it out, and I think that reflected a recognition the fact that perhaps that was a fairly broad interpretation of the statute. Some critics of the statute now point to the prosecution of Aaron Swartz as an example of overreach, and I think reasonable people can disagree about that, and we could probably do a whole episode about that. I have very strong views that he, although his death was tragic, it's a mistake to make him the martyr of the CFAA. And I'm personally glad the department doesn't bring cases for checking fantasy football scores, because I would be a repeat offender if that was the case. The issue is the provision in the statute that prohibits exceeding authorized access to a computer or a computer network. And in recent years, there's been a split that's developed in the circuits about the application of that provision. Mind you, not to people who lie about their age on dating sites, but rather to employees who abuse their access to their employer's computer systems to steal information that either harms the employer or benefits the employee or both. In the typical case where exceeding authorized access is used, an employee has access to information in order to do their jobs, but they exploit that access and use it to steal data for an improper purpose, either to just harm the company on their way out the door or to benefit a competitor or to have something of value to sell to a competitor. And there's a circuit split that's developed among the five circuits that have considered it, with the Fourth and the Ninth circuits narrowly construing the statute and saying that it doesn't cover employees who have access in the first place and just abuse that access. In fact, last week I think there was a district court opinion in the Ninth Circuit that repeated that analysis, whereas the Fifth, Seventh, and Eleventh circuits have interpreted the statute more broadly. So the headline this week in CFAA land was that the department is, at the same Senate Judiciary Committee hearing we spoke about earlier, is acknowledging that it may be appropriate to amend the statute to limit its scope so it can't be used to prosecute people for violating terms of service or other purportedly minor infractions. And the AG for the Criminal Division, Mike Thiemann, said the department would support amendments to that statute to make it less likely that people could be prosecuted for those types of infractions. That's not actually news, or at least it's not as much news as it's been portrayed in the press. I'm not even sure it's the first time the department has said that publicly, but even so, it's not a new position for the department to have taken. For the last several years, the department's not only been willing to support changes to the statute to address those issues, but when I was supervising CSTPs, the computer crime section of DOJ, we actually drafted several alternative proposals to address the issue that the critics of the statute have raised, right down to drafting statutory language that would make it impossible to bring a case just based on a terms of service violation, and that would limit the prosecution to cases in which information of great sensitivity and economic value was stolen. We worked with the Senate Judiciary Committee staff to pursue those proposals, and they were not adopted. But the virtue of those proposals is that they would address the concerns that the critics of the statute and the people who view Aaron Swartz as a martyr have raised. But they would do so while preserving the ability of the government and companies, because companies can use the statute to bring civil actions as well, to go after insider thefts of intellectual property and other important business information. There are currently efforts in Congress, including one by Zoe Lofgren, to amend the statute in ways that would be, I think, unwise. I could do an entire segment on my problems with Lofgren's bill, but what the fundamental problem with that bill is that in the effort to address what we'll call the Aaron Swartz problem, and I'm using significant air quotes there, it would eliminate effectively the government's or the employer's ability to go after the people who steal intellectual property. And Mike Lee Raman said at the hearing that one of the consequences of Nozzle, the Ninth Circuit case and the Fourth Circuit case and others, is that it is much more difficult to go after corporate insiders who abuse their access to harm their employers. And she's 100% right. So it's important, if Congress is going to go down the route of changing the statute, that they do it in a way that addresses these hypothetical concerns about overreach while preserving the department's ability and company's ability to go after actual thefts of intellectual property. It's something that all companies should really be concerned about. You know, if you're a corporate executive or a general counsel, you might read the Aaron Swartz case with passing interest without realizing that the statute at issue is one that will have a significant effect on your ability to protect yourself from insider thefts of your intellectual property.
Yeah, so it's a big deal for companies. I don't know that this was originally thought of as a law designed to deal with faithless employees, but it's certainly become a principal tool for companies that want to go after people who've left the company and taken a bunch of stuff with them. Well, that ends our news roundup. I'd like to start our interview. It's really a pleasure to have John Rizzo here. John probably is the guy I've known longest in Washington, because I knew him before either of us came to Washington. We were in college together. He has pictures, so I'm always very polite with him. And he's written a terrific book. If you're a lawyer and you're interested in intelligence, it's indispensable, because it is a deeply personal, as he says, he wrote every word of it, look at a 35-year career at the CIA, where he rose from being a junior lawyer to the first lawyer that the spies had, to becoming the deputy and often the acting general counsel. And in the course of that, had an unusual lawyer's view of almost every scandal that the CIA lived with since the Church Commission, and that's a lot of scandals. So welcome, John. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Stuart.
I'd like to start with a question that comes out of this. You write about every one of the directors of Central Intelligence, and you find something nice to say about every one of them. I thought that was politic, and probably also true, because we all like to like our clients. But some of them were very successful. Some of them were not so successful. It is my observation that the Central Intelligence Agency will kick their director to the curb if he doesn't deliver. It's a surprisingly harsh place on its bosses. What does it take to succeed at the agency as a director?
Yeah, I've been asked that in recent years since I left, and it seems to me there are three essential elements to make a CIA director successful. And as you know, Stuart, being CIA director is probably the ultimate of Washington no-win jobs. It's not a stepping stone to anything, and you consider yourself lucky if you emerge with your reputation intact. So it's one reason I think I was innately sympathetic to all of them, all 11 I served under, is the job is just so damn, such a potential disaster awaiting your career. So that played into it. Anyway, it seems to me that there are three basic qualities to make a CIA director successful. This is in no particular order, but at least in my view, if there were a first and foremost, it would be access to the president, access to the Oval Office, personal relationship with the president. That is essential. The second is a working relationship, if not a entirely, harmonious relationship with the Congress, the ability to work with the Congress, specifically the Intelligence Committee. Always a challenge, by the way. But the third is the ability to somehow relate in some inchoate way, unspoken way, perhaps, with the CIA workforce, with the career CIA workforce. As you indicated, you are correct. I worked with and observed three generations of career CIA personnel. And it's a unique culture there. They can sense when the top guy is on their side, and they can also sense when the top guy, frankly, could care less about them. And they do respond. They are spies, after all. They have their way. So those are the three essential elements.
So I noticed that in your book you have a picture inscribed by George Tenet, who said, "Well, John, you kept me out of the slammer." So clear that it was high on his list of the criteria by which he was going to judge the general counsel, and a classic George Tenet statement. Actually, how many directors of Central Intelligence were in fact pursued criminally? Deutsch was, right?
Deutsch was. Casey would have been, had he not died on the eve of the Iran-Contra hearing.
Helms had
Well, I'm old, Stuart, but Helms was actually before my time.
Let me ask you to give some advice to the National Security Agency, because we can't go 10 minutes here without talking about them these days. During the time that you were having 5-6 near-death experiences at the Central Intelligence Agency, the NSA was doing one thing. They took away from the Church Committee the notion that they should adhere to the law, that they should follow strictly and to the letter the legal restrictions on their intelligence gathering when it touched on Americans. Those were the principal legal restrictions. And that if they did that, they would be fine. And really, for 40 years, that's how it worked. They were uncontroversial and highly effective. 50, 60, 70% of what goes into the president's daily brief came from them. Now they've had a crisis in which, really, they didn't do anything illegal. I'm sure that the ACLU will tell us it was a violation of law, but the fact is they'd asked the courts, and the courts had said, no, this is legal. So the CIA has been dealing with these non-legal or quasi-legal attacks and coming back from it time and time again. What should NSA do that CIA has already learned to do to survive this kind of scandal?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I must say, I always, one does not like to take solace from other people or other agencies suffering, but for 34 years, I was so envious of NSA sitting out there. Many more people, many more bucks to spend, and they were untouchable, impregnable. Whereas CIA, every 12 minutes, we were going through some sort of a...
I think I once said, where did Snowden learn to hate the NSA the way he did? Well, it was when he was working at CIA, obviously.
Well, there were rivalries. I'm not sure CIA is the master in crisis control over the years, but there's one basic thing I would urge NSA to do. And that is, and this is especially true when you haven't done anything wrong, is not to, and this is not an easy thing to, I mean, it's easier said than done, not to react viscerally when you feel with justification that you're coming under unfair attack from either the media or the Congress. When you've done nothing wrong and you see and hear yourself being accused of vile, conspiratorial things, is human nature to want to hit back. And while the NSA can and is defending itself to the best extent possible, the one thing that is fatal, and I saw this several times at CIA, is in defending yourself, if you make any sort of wrong statement or go over the top in any way rhetorically, your opponents, your enemies will jump all over that. And you will not only not make any progress, you'll even regress. And that famous Washington expression will come up, that cover up, that NSA and CIA are covering up. They lie.
They're lying about it because they went over the top rhetorically defending themselves. They said, we never do that. And then it turns out you did it once in El Salvador.
Yeah. Now look at, as an example, look at James Clapper. I mean, a career military and civil service for 43 years. He makes one statement before the cameras in front of the Congressional Committee. And what happens? Members of Congress and the media basically accuse him of being a criminal. Now, that is the kind of toxic environment the CIA had to live with for many years. It is a shame, but... I mean, that is the one thing I would urge NSA to do. Be very, very measured in how you respond. Respond, but be very measured.
Yeah. Well, I think part of the problem the agency had is the National Security Agency had, they're so unused to responding that you could hear their joints creaking as they slowly found a way to say anything about what they were doing. They're learning, I think, and the CIA has learned how to talk about classified activities in ways that are not classified but which add to the dialogue, and NSA's got to learn that too. And I agree with you, they've got to learn to do it without saying things that they can't prove.
Yeah. It's also, again, I'm speaking from rueful experience here for years, you know, well, you were inside that national security bubble for years. I was inside it my entire career, so I recognize this now. I didn't recognize it when I was inside. Sometimes you just, because of you're inside the cone of silence, there's a great reluctance to show any kind of light publicly, even when it will help your case or dispute some calumny you're facing in the media. When CIA did make a decision to do that, I found that it did tend to put things into perspective, but it was hard. I remember it's hard when you're inside to sort of let go of classified information. But sometimes, in terms of self-protection, you need to do it.
Yeah. As I said, I think they're learning that lesson. It's just it's a very painful one. And frankly, there are folks in the upper reaches of their bureaucracy who will never learn that because they've spent 30 years learning the opposite. It is very tough. I think, you know, you are proof positive that you can go through half a dozen to a dozen crises where people are questioning why you exist, and come out the other end with some important allies and a mission that resembles the mission you started with. And part of that is just telling your story and demonstrating your value. The president, at the end of the day, stood up for NSA more than I actually expected him to in that speech. And that tells you something about how much he values what he's getting in the PDB.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I made a point in my book about why any president, regardless of political party, again, I served under seven, as soon as they walk in, they take that oath of office on January 20th, whatever year, and walk into the Oval Office and read their first PDB or get their first threat briefing. It tends to change a new president's perspective from what he might have had as a candidate. I certainly found that to be the case at CIA with new presidents, including President Obama. And, as you noted, Stuart, I sense the same dynamic. When it's on you for responsibility for protecting the country, you come to lean on your, and come to trust your intelligence organizations, and you tend to defend them. I mean, all laudable qualities, but sometimes seemingly dissonant from what the president, when he was a candidate, might have been saying. I'm not just talking about this president, but
Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
So you said that the relationship with the president is really crucial, and most of the time, the head of CIA is going to be a stranger or close to a stranger to the president. I always thought that delivering the intelligence brief each morning was part of the process by which the DCI would become the trusted source of intelligence and the confidant of the president on national security issues. But, of course, that role has been handed statutorily to the DNI. How much, and despite that, you know, Leon Panetta, who didn't get to do those briefs, is one of the most successful DCIs we've ever had. Does that mean that the daily briefings aren't that important?
No, they are important. And I'm of the view that that the idea of the CIA director being inside the room with the president when he gets his morning briefings is important. It's important substantively because these are not just sterile briefings. These are give and take between the president and his close advisors. A CIA director can hear it directly out of the president's mouth. So I think that's important. But I think also symbolically, when I said the idea of a successful CIA director having access to the president, that filters down to the troops. I'll give you an example. One CIA director I worked for in the early 90s, an extraordinarily smart lawyer and public servant named Jim Woolsey. You know Jim.
I know him well.
He was Bill Clinton's first CIA director. As Jim made no secret from the beginning, Clinton barely knew him, and he barely knew Clinton. He had, again, by his own admission, virtually no direct access to the Oval Office. You know, his candor in this regard was admirable. It's very un-Washingtonian to be so upfront about the fact you have no clout. So that's admirable. However, those of us sitting there in CIA would hear him say these things too. And I tell you, you start to wonder, well then, yeah, all this work we're doing, all this product we're producing, if our boss is a guy who has to buy a tourist ticket to get into the White House, what's the point? So perception is very important.
Yeah. In fact, I was around for those days, and the White House intel guy was George Tenet, who had just come over from the Hill. And that job had been a paper-moving job until George had it. And George has a big personality and great political instincts, and good political instincts took you a long way in the Clinton White House. And he ended up being enormously influential and ultimately becoming DCI, I think largely because Woolsey was not present and they turned to George for a lot of that.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely right. Yeah.
So let me ask, now that you're in private practice after 30-some years in government, what's the biggest surprise in private practice compared to your time in government?
Well, first of all, let me make clear, I spent 35 years at CIA. I've spent 3 at Steptoe. Oh, 3 very enjoyable years, but I can't say I have the same depth of experience and perspective in the two organizations. The biggest surprise about private practice, again, this is my first foray ever into private practice, and this may be a function of Steptoe, or it may apply across the board, but it's a positive surprise, actually, that in Steptoe, at least, I find that the lawyers here, at all levels, you get to be very creative with your client. You're called upon to use your imagination to offer advice in across the board, both policy and legal. But that, you know, all these years, I must have had a sort of a naive view of private practice that everyone looks at statutes and laws or the CFR every day and says to a client, okay, you're covered by subparagraph 3C4. You're either in good shape or you're screwed. I mean, I it was that simplistic. But the biggest surprise is that besides private practice being more lucrative, is that lawyers spend a lot of time, by necessity, being creative, and also, frankly, holding hands with your client to calm them down if they're in some regulatory or legal morass with the government, stuck in, you know, the netherworld of FARA or the Export Control Act. Those were kind of the functions I performed as a CI lawyer. I didn't realize they would translate so readily to private practice.
Yeah, well, part of it is if you charge what we charge, nobody's going to pay you to read the CFR. But I think that's right. That is the part that I most like about private practice, is the opportunity for creativity. You get it in government, too, right? Especially in a Washington practice, having an understanding that this is a problem that can be solved, instead of going through 5 years of discovery and getting a summary judgment order, maybe, given the climate, you can get a rider on an appropriations bill and solve your problem that way.
Yeah.
So the ability to kind of think in multiple dimensions is part of what we deliver.
Well, even knowing, you know, I mean, I won't get into specific cases, but let's say there's a visa problem. If you know what part of the State Department or what part of CIA or DHS, when you hear the client, what the problem is, you can immediately sense where to go to in those bureaucracies, those massive bureaucracies. That can be immensely important.
Yes, and it's, it makes you realize when you come out of government, there are some things you know that not everybody knows, and it's very valuable potentially to the clients. So let me just close with this, because I'm sure that some of the people who are listening are students or lawyers who would like to be involved in national security, intelligence law. What advice do you have for them?
Well, I did the hiring for CIA lawyers. Well, I was involved in hiring for years, but of course, the last 10 years, I was the final say on who came on board. And you know, it's a very subjective process, especially at CIA, to try to intuit in advance what kind of candidate you're looking for, because frankly, a lot of the areas one gets into as a CIA lawyer, there is no preparation for it in law school. I mean, first and foremost, when we talk to young people these days who ask me what it takes, it sounds simplistic, but it's absolutely true. Somewhere in your record, show some demonstrated, consistent desire to serve our country and serve the national security policy interests. Whether it be having lived abroad, internships at national security agencies, or even government think tanks specializing in foreign policy, something tangible to demonstrate your interest, because you know every once in a while I've come across people over the years, very very bright people, you know, terrific records, but I never got the sense that they were coming to CIA other than either, one, a lark, or two, they think it'd be kind of cool to be a CIA lawyer. And that was always an immediate turnoff for them. So if there is a credential to have when you walk in, it's that you're not a dilettante, I guess is the way I would sum it up.
Not like we were.
No. Yeah. Don't use my... With our listening out there, do not use my career as a template for how to proceed.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That's John Rizzo. His book is Company Man, and it's available wherever good books are sold, and certainly on Amazon. That's the end of Episode 6 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Michael Battis, Jason Weinstein, and John Rizzo. We hope you'll join us next week for insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. For more information, please visit our website at www.steptocyberblog.com. Thank you.